Thirsty? You've come to the right place to wet your whistle. It's the Liquid Lifestyle with Ryan McGarian, a full hour of liquid refreshment. Now, here's Ryan. Everybody was dancing
in the moonlight. And a very happy Saturday afternoon to you, my thirsty listener. And at the sound of my voice is flowing into your ears like a rich and well-balanced old-fashioned whiskey cocktail, you know that you're riding the earth with me here at the Liquid Lifestyle on the Radio Northwest Network. And as always, I am your host and on-air bartender, Ryan McGarian, where today we are sitting at Hamlet, my little cured ham and cocktail oasis in the Pearl District. And if you're joining us for the first time, the show of mine is dedicated to all things liquid and delicious. And specifically, we love talking spirits and cocktails and beers and wines, and we love talking coffee and tea, along with, of course, the fine folks and joints that serve them up, be them right here in the city of Roses, Hops, and Hipsters, or as you might have experienced in the past, parts far, far beyond. All right, so I am super stoked to be sitting here with my man Sean Horde. And if you are in and about the craft cocktail scene here in this country, that name is very, very well known. He's one of the most accomplished bartenders in America, if not the world. We are lucky to have him residing here in P-Town. He's done his time in the Big Apple, but we're going to talk to Sean. Sean has worked, man, he's worked at places like PDT, which is probably the most famous small format hidden bar in the world. Spent time with Jim Meehan over there, another really, really well-known and well-deserved bartender out there. And he's over here working, spent some time at the Teardrop, and now has his own business called The Commissary that we're going to talk about. But without further ado, Sean, what's cracking, my man?
That's quite an introduction, man. Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
Dude, it's good to have you, man. And, man, it's I'm so glad that we're going to be able to have this conversation because there's going to be so many layers to it. I mean, strap yourselves in if you're listening because Sean can speak to so much with regards to not only what's happening here in Portland and what he's doing, but just the evolution of the craft cocktail scene nationwide as a whole. So we're going to go all over the place. But, man, I just think we got to start things off. Like, you know, I'd love to hear, you know, we've been buds for a while, but where'd you come from, my man? I mean, like where'd you grow up and how did you get into this big old beautiful mess?
I grew up here. I went to Sunset High School. And then...
Whoa, you went to Sunset High School? I went to Sunset High School. I did not know this. I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Sunset High School, class of 05. And I went to college at NYU. While I was in college, I wrote a business plan. I should mention I studied music business in school. And I wrote a business plan for a venue that I wanted to open in Portland after I graduated. And an advisor very, very intelligently said to me, you know, if you're going to own a venue, you're going to make money on food and booze. Have you ever worked in a restaurant? And I said, no. And he was like, what the heck kind of college student are you? You never worked in a restaurant. You need to get a job in a restaurant. You need to see how that works. That's what's going to make you money. And a friend of mine who was in my program worked at a bar called White Star, which is a severely under-celebrated cocktail bar owned by the late Sasha Petrosky in New York City. And it was an amazing spot. And his name was Aaron. Aaron said to me, you know, if you're looking for a job in the service industry, I know a guy. That guy happened to be Jim Meehan, but I didn't know who Jim was at the time. And he said, Jim's looking for a bar back one day a week on Saturdays. Could you pull that off? And I was like, absolutely. So I started bar backing at PDT, and I don't want to say the rest is history because I'm still kind of in the middle of it. But
well, I'm going to lead you through that a little bit. But, I mean, you kind of – I remember a conversation with Sasha way back in the day, and he was just talking about White Star for the first time. I recall it was supposed to be a sparkling wine bar, and I know that anybody who knew Sasha, man, he loved his daiquiris. He loved his champagne, yes, that guy did. Yes, and did. Is the White Star still there? I can't remember.
To be honest, I don't know. Okay. I think it closed, but, I mean, this was in 2008 that we were going there a lot, and this was as college students, and we were drinking, like, sea fizzes. We were drinking absinthe fizzes. We were drinking, you know, arsenic and old lace. I mean, we had no business drinking what we were drinking. When all my friends were drinking, you know, vodka and Red Bull, and no disrespect to vodka and Red Bull, but, like, we were drinking these incredible cocktails because of my friend Aaron. So it provided a bit of context for me to understand PDT, but I had no idea what I was about to get into.
Dude, so from Oregon, from Sunset High School, get over to New York, get your learning on. Your boy Aaron hooks you up with this bar back gig at this place called PDT. For those who don't know about it, this bar, It's called Please Don't Tell, and it was a revelation worldwide with regards, again, to small format kind of cocktail experiences. So you get in there, you meet Jim Meehan, who's one of the most respected bartenders in the world, author of the PDT cocktail book, worldwide consultant. And what were those early days like, you know, working with Jim and being at a PDT at such an exciting time?
It was incredible. I was at a point in my career where I was deciding if I was going to continue, in the music industry. I was lucky enough to be working at Def Jam at the time, and I'll never forget a night. Well, so I barbacked one day a week, just so it sounds, you know, getting ice, cutting garnishes, bussing tables, greeting guests, pouring them water. It was pretty simple, but the stakes were high, and I loved that. I mean, we were held to a really high standard of excellence. Guests were paying $15 a cocktail, you better make sure that water glass is full, you know, and you better smile while you do it. And I loved that. I really thrived on that. And I was at a point in my career where I was deciding, am I going to be done with college and become a bartender and tell my parents that? Or was I going to continue in the music industry? And I was so taken aback by how much the staff took me under their wing. And not just the staff at PDT, but the staff at other bars when they saw this young kid basically barbacking. And they were buying me drinks at the best bars in Portland just because they knew I couldn't afford to be drinking there. And I was just there to learn. So as stressful as it was and as intense as it was to work there on a nightly basis, the sense of hospitality was really ingrained in me right away because I was just this nobody and everybody treated me like I was somebody because I was working my butt off. So...
Well, you're definitely somebody. Once again, we're chatting with Sean Horde, who is the co-owner and proprietor of The Commissary. And we could talk all about that a little bit later on down the line in this episode. But Sean, I mean, how many years did you put in once you became a... when did you move from barback to bartender? How long did it take to move from that position of barback to bartender?
It took about a year. And it was really exciting because the barback who had trained me was named Victor. He's from Puebla, Mexico, the coolest guy ever. And he'd worked over at Criff Dogs, which is the adjacent hot dog stand, essentially, to PDT. And Victor was a barback and was being trained to be a bartender while I was sort of taking over as head barback or whatever. And at that time in New York, it was really interesting because there were a bunch of quote-unquote celebrity bartenders or star tenders or whatever you want to call them, sort of bouncing around from nice cocktail to nice cocktail bar. And what Jim did, which I thought was really incredible, was he said, I'm going to train somebody with no experience. I'm going to train Victor. And at the time, he was working on the PDT cocktail book. So Victor and I got to work on sections of it as like sort of a manual. We were using it almost as like a staff manual at that time. And just to watch Jim and the rest of the staff sort of embrace Victor, it was a really exciting year for me to know, okay, my time's coming. So it took about a year. And then I bartended there for a little over 2.5 years.
Dude, and if any of you have been to PDT, I mean, they do exquisite cocktails, perfection's the name of the game, but they also do some pretty hefty volume. When you put all those things into the kettle, that is kind of, that can be a really tough thing to kind of manage. So, I guess I'm just curious, I mean, that must have been very physically exhausting, you know, and how long were those shifts? And tell me about a night at PDT, man.
Yeah, we get in about 4, we start prepping, we open at 6. The way PDT works is it's day of reservations only. So at 3 p.m. you call a sort of hotline phone number and we book up in about 10 minutes. So we're booked solid all the way through. Most nights we closed at 2, on the weekends we closed at 4. So you're looking at, 12 to 14 hour shifts.
Dude, 12 to 14 hour shifts. It's funny because I'll hear people complain about 8 hours. It's just like, you have no idea what some of the leathernecks in our industry have like dealt with, like 12 to 14 hours of making freaking sea fizzes and good grief. So that's brutal. You're a fit guy, but man, you must have been a stick back then.
Yeah, it was, if not for all the hot dogs we ate next door as our nourishment, I probably would have been more of a stick. But yeah, I mean, I think that it ingrained in me a work ethic that I'm really proud of and excited about. I think that, one of the things New York City's good at is making sure you know how sort of small you are and how hard you have to work to get where you want to be. So I was really grateful for that.
Dude, I mean, it's so, yeah, I mean, because I've been fortunate enough to have been exposed to the New York scene when it was just evolving. And man, it was so intense. It remains intense. But man, the competition, the competitive nature. But that's what's so great about competition is it really breeded, I mean, more than any place in the world. What happened in New York from like 2004 to 2012 changed the landscape of cocktails like really no other place on earth. But we got to jump out. That's the end of the first round. Folks, we'll be back at you in just a moment. And welcome back to the Liquid Lifestyle here on the Radio Northwest Network. Hope you are enjoying a very relaxing, hopefully refreshing Saturday afternoon. Perhaps you have a big old frosty pint of Barley Brown's Pallet Jack, or maybe you've got a Spanish coffee in your grubby little mitts. Who knows? Maybe nothing. But yeah, we just hope you're having a great time. And once again, we're chatting with Sean Hoard. Sean is one of America's, if not one of the world's great craft bartenders with an incredible pedigree. In the first round, if you didn't hear it, we were just kind of... Sean's from here in Portland, man. He went to Sunset High School, but you know, did college in New York. And you know, ended up becoming a bartender at one of the world's most notable intellectual kind of temples of craft cocktails, and that is PDT, which if anybody knows anything about craft cocktails, that's a big freaking deal. So we talked a lot about PDT, Sean, and I actually want to segue because, you know, the New York cocktail scene, the precision, the kind of template scientific kind of orientation that existed or continues to exist there has always been a huge influence on me. I just thought it was a good opportunity to kind of let's just talk about that New York kind of cocktail scene. And, you know, as I think, you know, most people in our industry kind of know, I mean, it really started with Dale DeGroff, right? Yeah. It started with Dale, who was commissioned. Dale's probably the most famous bartender in the world, and for good reason. Dale was commissioned to do, it was a restaurant Aurora by a famous restaurateur named Joe Baum. And I remember hearing that Joe, like, demanded that Dale do what we would call today a pre-prohibition bar, where everything was fresh, detailed, you know, spirit-forward drinks. And the rest really trickled off that, didn't it?
Yeah, I feel like it did. I mean, for me, you know, being a couple years younger, Pegu Club was really that for me. And Pegu was started by two of Dale's disciples, Audrey Saunders and Julie Reiner. And the opening staff at Pegu informed basically every meaningful bar while I was there. You know, Jim Meehan was there, Jim Kearns was there, Sammy Ross was there, Toby was there. I mean, it was a murderer's row. I mean, to use a baseball reference, every single night was a superstar bartender, or to be, you know, someone that was going to become something incredible. Phil was there. I mean, it was insane. So for me, Pegu Club was really where that all came from. And it's amazing because Pegu Club comes from Dale.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And I mean, I think I love to draw a little diagrams of how things, like, everything has to be like in its little box with me. You know how that goes, Sean. But you know, I see Dale as kind of like the sun in the cocktail solar system, so to speak. And everything kind of trickles off. He's kind of like the punch. Yeah. Everything starts with Dale. But you know, like you said, I agree with that. With Pegu Club, I think that was Pegu Club. I'd even draw lines to Flatiron and to Milk and Honey. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. I mean, for me, you know, working at PDT, and PDT is one of my favorite places in the world. Milk and Honey was a place of you know, talk about cocktail temples. Milk and Honey was where I had one of my first sort of aha cocktail moments. I was served by Mickey and Sam Ross and Mickey McElroy, for those who don't know, in my opinion, are combined the greatest bartender, you know, like Voltron, like they assemble to form the greatest bartender maybe that's ever lived. And I really looked up to those guys, and Milk and Honey for me was this really special place. You know, I held it very, very dear to my heart. It's now an amazing bar called Attaboy that has just a ton of soul and all the good parts of Milk and Honey, but it serves more people. But I have to say, the thing to me about New York that stands out is the way that the industry takes its own and makes them better. I mean, Sammy and Mickey would come sit at my bar Mondays and Tuesdays and just harass me, you know? I mean, if I shook a drink too long, if my shirt wasn't tucked in well, you know, it was like they gave me a hard time, but they made me so much better. And it was crazy to me to have these two guys that I really looked up to, frankly, as bartenders, then come in and kind of bug me and harass me into being a better bartender, and we're still great friends to this day, so...
Dude, why does that not surprise me? Because my first experience with Sam Ross, who was an early Milk and Honey bartender, one of the best in the world, was at Little Branch.
Yep.
And dude drew testicles into the Angostura on the top of my Pisco Sour. And, you know, it just was like, you know, this guy's something else, right? I mean, like, yeah, I agree. Like, they are kind of the Voltron bartender, him and Mickey. And I don't know that I've actually met Mickey, but I know him by reputation. But so, yeah, it's really cool. New York, Dale, you know, I agree. Pegu Club, Milk and Honey, Flatiron, and then from there, there's such clear like trickle down with regards to talent. What do you think sets apart? You know, I always talk about the fact that the East Coast seems to really be more captivated, I guess, by the science, the simple sciences of strong, weak, sweet, sour, and bitter, where the West Coast has always seemed to be more captivated by the innovation of flavors. Would you agree with that to some degree?
I mean, when I started working at Teardrop, to be totally honest, I was scared of all the bitters and tinctures and tonic water and ginger beer that they were making in-house. You know, I said to Daniel, the owner, who's now my business partner, why would you make these things? We don't need more bitters than Peychaud and Orange and Angostura. I mean, like, what are all these for? Like, we have all the tools we need. And I think that having to create with a, I don't want to say limited, but a specific color palette that we all sort of agree on as New Yorkers, you know, you have... Everybody's buying the same apricot brandy. Everybody's got chartreuse. Whatever it is, we have this sort of agreed upon color palette so we can all paint the same things. And a guest can go in and ask for a penicillin, or a guest can go in and ask for a Rosita and knows that they'll get a similar version at each sort of New York spot. And in Portland, it's not like that at all. I mean, you can't get a similar daiquiri at five different bars, which is great. And I don't think one's better than the other. But I think that the way that New York sort of developed, it became about how you made the drinks and less about the recipe or the development of the ingredient. So it was more focused on technique and dilution and temperature and how cold are your glasses when you pull them out. Whereas in Portland, there were these big, beautiful, bold, new flavors that were so jarring and exciting. The technique was less of a focus. I'm not saying it was less important. I think there's technically incredible bartenders here in Portland, but I'd never really thought about it until you just said it then, but that's kind of how I feel about, you know, how those two scenes developed.
Quite simple, man. You've got Eastocution and Westivation, man. I'm going to roll that out. I know, right? On the spot.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Wow.
But I totally agree with that. I mean, I always feel like the New York style was an obsession with mother sauces, if I was going to use a culinary reference. Just kind of being sticking tight to those, and that's why I've always felt like the balance points have always been, or I've found the drinks that come out of that school, so to speak, to be so sessionable and repeatable. But that is kind of what's so special about Portland. And I'd argue that San Francisco and Seattle really, they're all kind of an extension of each other. It's just the innovation in the industry with regards to flavors and pushing the boundaries on homemade ingredients. I really feel like that stuff is coming from the West Coast, and it sounds like you agree with that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, for me, my business partner inspired me greatly. I mean, I remember the first time I asked him if we could do a rhubarb daiquiri one of my first years at Teardrop, and we were working on the menu. And I was like, hey, can we just put together a rhubarb syrup? And at the time, Daniel was making every house-made ingredient. I mean, we're talking probably two dozen both traditional and sort of new innovative things.
And I got to jump in real quick, Sean. We are at the end of our second round. Time is flying. Hope you guys are really enjoying this. I know I am. We'll be back at you in just a few. And welcome back to the Liquid Lifestyle here on the Radio Northwest Network, where we are kicking it, chatting with Sean Hoard, co-proprietor of The Commissary, which we're going to learn all about in just a few minutes. Also, former bartender at Teardrop Lounge here in Portland, one of the world's great cocktail bars. And if that was not enough, he is also an alum of PDT, another one of the world's fantastic and most relevant and influential cocktail bar. So this guy has pedigree for eons. So Sean, just to kind of recap on the last segment, it was so much fun. I really enjoyed that conversation about New York and, like, you know, the difference between, you know, early perspectives on mixing drinks and focuses that we saw in New York and on the East Coast, or I'd say more specifically New York, and the real kind of what was happening over here on the West Coast, you know, just being on the forefront of innovating flavors. And, you know, I kind of want to move back to Portland, your triumphant return to P-Town, and you ended up getting that gig at Teardrop. But you were talking about ingredients, and I want to recap. You want to reset that rhubarb daiquiri situation you were talking about?
Yeah, I don't, for whatever reason, I wanted to make a rhubarb daiquiri, and I looked at Daniel, who at the time, you know, I'd mentioned, was making all the ingredients in-house, and I sort of outsourced it. I said, hey, Daniel, do you mind, you know, can we put together some sort of rhubarb syrup, not having a better name for it? And I think he did it that night. Like, I was working, it was like a Monday, and it was a little bit slow, and he just went in the back and put it together.
As he does.
Yeah, exactly. And he came out, what he came out with was this, like, complete vision. I mean, it was this insanely complex, robust, like, incredible. And I was like, what is this? I said, cook down some rhubarb with sugar and water. He was like, oh, that, you know, that just wouldn't do. There's a little vino verde in here, some cinnamon, some vanilla. I mean, it was incredible. So that when I put it together with the cocktail, you know, it had all this dimension and complexity. And so working with Daniel really inspired me and informed me, frankly, on all the merits and virtues of making your own ingredients and what, you know, what kind of creativity you could have there that wasn't just in the combination of the colors that we had all agreed on in New York. This was more about, like, let's make them new colors. Let's make them new paints. Let's paint with, you know, watercolors. We don't even need to do acrylic, you know. So Daniel really, really, that excited me and kind of scared me, frankly, because it was like, oh my gosh, there's too many possibilities now.
Well, dude, I'll tell you, Daniel's talent still intimidates the crap out of me, man. He's the Muhammad Ali of, like, homemade ingredients in our industry, isn't he, man? I mean, that guy is just, dude, and just what I hear you, like, you know, I can just picture that. You're like, hey, let's get some rhubarb syrup going, dude. And, you know, he goes back into the lab and he just pulls out all this stuff. And it's just fun. It's like, our industry is kind of like the super friends sometimes. Like, and everybody has their, like, superpower, and, like, Daniel's superpower is, like, homemade, like, refined homemade, like, you know, you go in a Teardrop, and folks, you know, most of you probably heard of this place, but if not, you got to check out the Teardrop Lounge right here in the center of the Pearl District, man, one of the world's, like, great cocktail bars, and you know, owned and founded by Daniel Shoemaker. And you won't see a bar anywhere in the world more dedicated to homemade ingredients. So how did you sync up with Daniel? I mean, tell me about how you ended up at the Teardrop when you moved back. What year was that, man?
That would have been 2012, 2011. Gosh, now you're asking me to do math on the fly. This is embarrassing.
Dude, I know, man. I failed out of math 101 at U of O.
And maybe it was 2010. But Daniel, we have this big sort of dorky summit sort of convention in New Orleans every year, as you know, called Tales of the Cocktail. And Daniel went down to Tales. I didn't realize this until afterwards, essentially to recruit me. He had heard I was talking about coming out here, and I was lucky enough to have worked a guest shift at Teardrop when I came home to visit a family one year. I said to Jim, hey, I would love to guest bartend in Portland. What's the bar to do it? Where should I go? And he said, you know, there's Clyde Common and there's Teardrop. I think Teardrop would be a great fit for you. Let me reach out to Daniel. Within a week, I was out here, bartended, blown away by the guests, blown away by the bartenders. It was Brian Gilbert and Dave Chanot at the time. And Daniel came out to Tales and courted me. So when I moved back, I drove. I took about 30 days, and I didn't realize, but Daniel was essentially just working my shifts, not knowing what day exactly I'd be home, just kind of holding on. So I was very lucky. Daniel wanted me to work there, and you know, was hospitable enough to save me some shifts.
Dude, that's really, really cool, man. That's got to feel, that's pretty flattering, man. Like, the owner of one of the great cocktail bars in the world would come out, and man, we all know that you're absolutely 100%, 110% well worth that, but that's got to feel pretty good, right?
Oh, I was floored. I mean, and once I found out, I was almost kicking myself because I wish he had told me. We would have just got here quicker, you know. A buddy of mine came out to New York with me. We took about 30 days. We did the Jack Kerouac thing, and we could have gone a little quicker, you know, had I had known. So I was very lucky. Shortly thereafter, got two shifts at Clyde, which was really exciting. So I worked for a year for Jeffrey Morgenthaler and Daniel at the same time, which informed so much of how I think about drinks even now.
Dude, I can't think. I mean, that's just, when you think about, like, the opportunity to learn in our industry, the fact that you've had the opportunity to work at PDT and be a part of that early New York kind of bar community, and then to get to Portland and then to get a job at the Teardrop and to work with Daniel, the Muhammad Ali of homemade ingredients, man. We have to hit him with that. And then Jeffrey Morgenthaler, who just his ability to captivate with his unique kind of, with his ingredient driven cocktails. And you know, one thing about Jeffrey is, like, what a communicator that guy is. That guy's changed the game and how he communicates our craft to others, man. And he's probably, and you know, he was, you know, I have this radio show because he passed on it. That's the reality of it. You know, he's a big, big deal. So to get, wow, what a multi-layered learning experience to kind of to tuck into your back pocket. So tell us, you know, you did your 12, 14-hour shifts at PDT in the dark over there, man. What's a shift like, what's a night like at Teardrop, man?
Teardrop was a long shift too. I remember talking to Portland bartenders about the idea of like a swing shift or an opener or a closer. It was like a Teardrop. It was the same thing. You got in, you opened, you juiced, or at the time we were juicing all the minute, and then you bartended till it was time to lock the doors. So it was fun because I'd never served before, and at Teardrop back in the old days, we just had two bartenders, no server. So you, on a busy summer Wednesday, you were basically jogging to get orders out to the patio and be back behind the bar making drinks. So it was a grind. It was a very fun grind and really, I think, suited me given that I'd come from New York and was used to the long hours there. So I loved it. I loved the way that it galvanized us as a team, having these like long kind of brutal shifts, knowing Daniel could work them too. We all just sort of, we battled the busy Pearl off on Saturdays in the summer and it really helped us kind of bond as a team.
That's so cool, man. You guys battle it up there. Once again, we're chatting with Sean Horde, the proprietor of the commissary, former bartender at PDT, former bartender at Teardrop Lounge as well, Clyde Common. I kind of forgot that throughout the course of this conversation. But, man, I think it's time to take the next step in this conversation. Let's talk about your new baby, man, the commissary. I've thought from the very beginning, the idea of what you guys were doing was not only important for P-Town, for what you're doing with regards to getting people easy access to world-class ingredients and they don't have to even think about it, but I just think the template, the idea of it is something that's super relevant worldwide. Tell us about the freaking commissary, Sean.
We, at Teardrop, we had two full-time prep people and we were spending about 10 hours a day in labor on prep. And as a business owner, that's a lot of money. And we sort of asked around. We asked people like you and Jeff and, other bartenders and owners around town, hey, if we could consolidate this labor, would you guys be interested if we could do it for cheaper than you're doing it yourself? And for those that don't know, the commissary juice is fresh daily. It's unpasteurized juice. We deliver it sort of like the milkman of yesteryear. In addition to fresh pressed citrus, we do really traditional cocktail ingredients like orgeat, which is a sweetened aromatized almond milk, and pineapple gum, which is essentially just a thickened pineapple syrup. But we also do bottle fermented sodas, really straightforward things like cucumber syrup. So it was born out of this idea of like, let's make it easier for everybody else. Let's make it easier for bar owners. Let's make it easier for bartenders. Let's make it easier for bar managers and consolidate all this sort of prep we were all doing.
So, like I said, I was thinking today about a Steve Jobsism. You're either first, you're finest, or you're, I'm not going to use the expletive, but you know where I'm going with this. And, you were first. And it could be really a challenge because, to be finest, it's like you look around, and if you're good at something, you just do what everybody wants. You just do it better. But you were first to market. How are things going for you guys?
They're going really well, and I'm, it was terrifying. It was really terrifying to be first. It was exhilarating, but it was terrifying when you got no's or if people were like, I just don't get why I would pay for this. Lemon juice is free when I make it myself. Having to explain a need to someone is a really interesting exercise, and we got better at it. It's going really well now, but being first is a lot scarier than I thought it would be.
Yeah, being first is a lot... I think it's a lot harder than being finest because eventually you're first and then you got to be the finest while everybody else is kind of trying to come up your butt, so to speak, and get behind you. So yeah, I know I've seen your products all over the place. Tell us about some of the ingredients that you think, I know everything you do is world class, but are there a few things you make that you just feel like you slaughter?
Yeah, it's fun working with Daniel because he comes at it from the owner's perspective and I come at it from the bartender's perspective. I think we slaughtered mint syrup and cucumber syrup, and we had to slaughter them because there's nothing more annoying than picking mint out of a Hawthorne strainer or...
Got to jump in real quick, man. Once again, we're talking with Sean Horde of the commissary. Man, what a sweet conversation. We're at the end of our third round, final round coming at you in just a moment. And welcome back to the Liquid Lifestyle here on the Radio Northwest Network. Hope you're having a fine, fine afternoon here in the Rose City or in the great words of Bill Shonley, wherever you may be. And we are chatting with Sean Horde, the proprietor of the commissary and the former bartender at Teardrop Lounge, PDT in New York, and Clyde Common. And just to kind of tie in our last segment, man, we were talking about obviously your commissary that provides fresh ingredients, fresh juices, homemade syrups, all that amazing stuff to bars all around the city, which I think is going to be a linchpin kind of opportunity for a lot of bars that normally might not take that extra step. And now that you've made it so easy, they will take that extra step. So in a lot of ways, on a very macro level, I think you're pushing the craft forward, which is really, really super awesome. And we were talking specifically about some of the things you just think you crush. And you said the mint and cucumber syrup. And I just assume that's because you've gotten them super consistent and that they just have bombastic flavor. Is that kind of what you're thinking?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the goal is that we can go in and a bar can change to using the commissary, and the guests won't know. The guests will still get the drinks they love. They'll still get their cucumber, you know, mojito or whatever it is that calls for those ingredients. It's just going to taste a little bit better, and it's going to be easier for the bartenders. And then from a costing standpoint, the owner knows exactly how much those ingredients cost. They don't have to deal with the fluctuation in price of produce. So it's been really exciting. In terms of ingredients we slay, I love those too. I love our orgeat a lot. I love all the things that were annoying to make as a bartender. I love our ginger syrup because I don't have to, you know, I'm not sitting there peeling the ginger and juicing the ginger. So as a selfish bartender, I love the ones that make the bartender's lives easier.
Yeah, and I bet that mint syrup is probably just in the minds of the local bartenders that use it is just like a game changer to be able to knock out a mojito or a Southside without the muddling and just to make it as if you were making a simple sour. Man, what a revelation, you know. And that's the tough thing about a mojito, because to this day, I am an unashamed top three cocktails or top three beverages, adult beverages for me. I mean, a properly made light rum mojito with, you know, a good burst of rum, good acidity, but just great amplification by the sugar of the mint. Man, it is like one of the most magical things to put in your face, like on this whole planet. And the fact that you're making it easier, and, you know, most bartenders, I mean, it's kind of a pain in the butt drink to make. So you're doing God's work there, I believe, with that mint syrup, my man. So you got the commissary, it's up and running. Do you have any plans to expand outside of P-Town?
We do, yeah. It's been a very exciting and, again, scary proposition to be the first commissary in another market. We're exploring three cities right now, and it's that same feeling all over again of opening a new business, right? I mean, we've done it before, but we haven't done it before in the city that we're going to do it in. So much of what we were able to accomplish was built on the relationships that we have here. I mean, I'd bartended here for years. Daniel owned a bar for years. And we were able to build off those relationships, at least at the start. It's a little bit scarier going into a new market. Yes, we have a developed product. Yes, we have a developed system. But now we're building those relationships. So we are talking about one city this year and then looking towards the future, maybe three in the next few years. So
that's awesome, man. I mean, just like I said, you're filling a niche in a layer in an industry that it's almost like it's an amplification of quality that you can offer the industry widely, which is really, really, really cool. Man, we were talking over lunch about, you know, I just with your talent, with the balance of your drinks, the way your hospitality forward mentality, like, man, the world needs a Sean Horde cocktail bar. Is there any plans down the road to broach that, or would you ever consider that, Sean?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I love Portland, and I love being from here, and I love the drinking culture that's developing here. And I love the people, you know, that drink here, frankly. I mean, that's what I was most struck by when I moved from New York, was the way that people engage here with what they're eating and drinking is, I think, what's so remarkable. You know, it's not the restaurants and bars, it's the guests that come in and how they engage. So I would love to have regulars of my own. I would love, you know, I think that every bartender is a little bit of a diva, and I think you want to have a whole big expression of that a little bit. So I would love to own a bar here, yes.
And, you know, I totally agree about the clientele, the guests here in Portland. I mean, you don't move here for sun and, you know, you don't move here for sports. I mean, the Timbers are pretty dope and the Blazers, whatever. But for real, like, Portland's built on flavortainment, like enjoying the cocktails and the beers and the wines, the coffee, the cocktails. Like, if that is not something you enjoy, it's kind of not the right city for you, is it?
No, because the guest next to you is going to want to talk to you about it, even if they don't know you, or they're going to be jawing with the bartender. I mean, I think it keeps the servers in our industry very sharp, which is why I think people really respect our hospitality industry. But I really think it comes from the guests and their level of education and willingness to be involved and spend money on quality things.
Yeah, it's really cool. It's a great town to be an artisan with regards to anything food and beverage, and because there's so much interest and respect and such a knowledge base. It's just fun. It's really fun to play to. I mean, like, you go to Teardrop, it's like the people sitting at the bar are almost as knowledgeable as the freaking bartenders themselves. Like, what other city can you say that? Well, there's a couple, but not many. But man, we're at the end of the show, dude. That's the end of round four. And Sean, so sick hanging out with you, man. And dude, I just always just think good thoughts for you. I'm always wishing you the best, and it'll be fun to watch what Sean Hoard does in the coming year. So once again, you've been listening to The Liquid Lifestyle. We are out of here. Catch you next week.